On Sunday, August 7th at 11 p.m., Suge and My Bowl presents drummer, composer, guitarist Will Calhoun. Join us as we discuss Will Calhoun's celebration of Elvin Jones with his latest CD release as we do what we can to help keep this listener-supported experiment alive. That's Sunday, August 7th at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program of which you are listening. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is Will Calhoun. Will Calhoun has a new release. It is going to be released on the 19th of this month, but we get to share it with you this evening, and for a pledge of $25, it can be yours as a thank you for your generous support by calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. The name of the release from Motema Records is Celebrating Elvin Jones. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some sugar in my bowl.
My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Will Calhoun.
Hey, Will Calhoun. Thank you for joining Sugar My Bowl.
Pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad we're able to do this. You're on the other side of the United States right now.
That's correct. I'm in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Are you still celebrating Elvin Jones over there?
I'm celebrating Elvin Jones every day of my life, so the answer to that question is yes.
Actually, I want to go somewhere first because we opened the show with Street Priest by Ronald Shannon Jackson, and we, Hank and I, saw you at Iridium with the, MWV or Zigzag Power Trio or Vernon Reed Power Trio. I noticed the connecting thread is Ronald Shannon Jackson, so what exactly is the influence that he's had on your playing?
Well, guys like Ronald Shannon Jackson and Jack DeJohnette and Don Moyer, there's a few more. These are drummers that I was really interested in their approach to playing acoustic music and jazz, so to speak. I don't want to call it jazz. I know there's all of these titles, harmonic jazz and alt music, etc. But I think Ronald Shannon Jackson developed a new vocabulary for the instrument, in my opinion, at least a new approach to the drumming vocabulary that already existed. And it was very unique, very powerful. It had essence of jazz. It had essence of indigenous drumming. It had essence of straight-up dance music. It had essence of rock. So you knowing me, you know, Shannon Jackson is definitely an influence heavily. And I would say the last time I had a great opportunity to hang with Shannon, Melvin Gibbs and Vernon and Shannon were playing a jazz festival in Poland. I think I was over there with my Native Lands group, and Shannon's room was right across the hall from mine. I opened my door to go to breakfast, and Shannon's putting his key in the door, you know?
Wow.
And I'm like, what's going on here? So, of course, he knows me, and we spoke, and I invited him to breakfast, and we talked, and I got to hear really more about the Shannon Jackson, where he comes from, and his music, and those records, and his approach to drumming. I've always met Shannon kind of on a gig, and we didn't have a chance to talk, and we really have a lot in common, and I say that only with the utmost respect to what he's brought to the table, and he really loves Living Color and my approach to rock and roll, etc. But more importantly, it was a little bit sad. Sometimes on these festivals, you don't have the right gear, or the promoter doesn't provide the right gear for you. He struggled a little bit with the drums, and it's almost like tech for him that day. I had a day off. So it was even more of an honor to help set up his gear and put the cymbals on and watch him play and sit behind a kit during the show. You know, it was, for me, that was front row of a boxing match sort of kind of a thing for me to watch him play. And then, you know, we both played exotic wind instruments, mainly more into the Asian flutes. And we talked about playing wind instruments and breath techniques and how when you play drums, you kind of like breathe through your nose, like an athletic thing. And this allows you to have different kind of breathing exercises when playing wind instruments. It's kind of easier to approach because we're accustomed to kind of breathing a certain way when we're playing our instrument, almost like a swimmer's technique with oxygen that you have when you're playing the instrument. So we talked about many, many things. Ronald Shannon Jackson, extremely bright intellectual on top of that, and spiritual, you know, Buddhist. So we talked about family and life and love and money and this business that we're in and commitment to the instrument and the history of the instrument. So it was fantastic. And I felt like a lot of what he had already experienced and things he informed me of about the industry and drums and sound and technique, I took it under my wing to investigate and introduce to my own playing.
That sounds like a beautiful gift to have met him. Speaking of Living Color, though, the group has a release coming up. Anything you want to share about that?
Sure. Long overdue, but we learn in this business that art takes its time. It can be a really fast bolt of lightning and be incredible, and it can be a tortoise in a hair race. And it took a while. I think Living Color is a very organic, spiritual entity, and we don't operate really on shit academics. So, yes, the producing situation and the songs and the sounds and where we wanted to record, the industry has changed the game for many artists. We were accustomed and we sort of grew up playing in the same room and recording our records the way we played live. We all plugged in together and we just counted the songs off and we cut everything raw. And this was the first time, I think, in a band's history where we did a combination of things. We did sessions as a band. We did sessions separately. We did duos and trios and single parts. And so it took a bit longer to make the sandwich, but it's a beautiful sandwich now. And it's coming out next year. And I'm excited about the first release. We are releasing a mixtape at the end of the summer. And it's featuring the cover song, Biggie's intelligently rap song called Who Shot Ya? And in the climate of what's going on right now in this country and out of this country,
right,
we felt like this topic and this title and this song is very important to state. Two songs, I think, that relate to that topic. And I would say, more importantly, us us as people of color in that topic, we covered Marvin Gaye's Inner City Blues and we covered Kushacha. So there'll be some remixes. We got some great surprises on the record. You know, Black Thought, I just received the text, just put a verse down. And we're talking to a few other folks. So, yeah, we're connected to that community. We all come from that community. I'm born and raised in the Bronx, as you know, and that's the home of hip-hop. And all of the great artists that come out of Brooklyn and Queens and Harlem, etc. Doug was the house bass player for Sugar Hill Records. So we all do have our deep roots into hip-hop, and we're very connected to it. So that's going to come out in late summer. The title's called Shade. The album's called Shade. And Shade will be released early 2017.
Oh, wonderful news. Also, on the subject of Living Color, I've read that you informed Vernon Reid when he was looking for a drummer that you were a jazz drummer. Well, just to use that language, you were a jazz drummer, not really a rock drummer. You want to elaborate on that?
Well, this is what happened. Vernon gave me a tape of Living Color, and JT Lewis, who's a tremendous drummer, who was there that night as well, actually.
Yes, I found out.
I'm a fan of JT's. JT was playing drums. He had a different lineup at the time, and it was almost like instrumental jazz fusion-y art rock.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me when JT and Carl James, he was basically changing musicians in the band, and Corey joined and I joined and Muzz joined. What he gave me, I said, okay, this is cool, but he said, no, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm doing this rock thing. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he goes, well, I'm just going to play rock and roll. And his tone was adamant, and I didn't think he was trying to do anything other than what he did. I felt Vernon's vibe was, you know, towards history of where he came from in a rock sense. I didn't think he was going to try to, you know, put like a Van Halen band together. But to connect the story, when I graduated, Jaco Pastorius, let me start from the beginning, introduced me to Vernon Reid in 55 Grand during one of my Escape from Boston weekends as a student at Berkeley to come to see what I thought was the greatest band in New York at that time, Bushrock, which featured Kenwood Dinard, Ray L. Wesley Grant, and Delmar Brown. And it was the band that I thought just scared everyone in New York. Everyone went to see it, but everybody was hiding in the club because the music was so amazing and frightening that, unlike me, who sat in the front and bootlegged every show, everybody else was kind of hiding around in the club. And Jaco, for those who know the history of that venue, Jaco kept his bass at the bar, and a lot of times he would jump on stage, invited and not invited, to join your set.
Oh, wow.
And he never touched his bass when Bushrock played. He always watched. So that told you the level of the music. But Jaco introduced me. I did a session with Jaco where he played piano and had a bass player, and he was writing the music then, which was the beginning of his word of mouth record. And he said, you should meet this cat. And I assumed Vernon was a bass player because Jaco was telling me, you got to hook up with this cat, man. This cat's interesting. So all of those years before I hooked up with Vernon, I thought he was a bass player. I finished school, came home, met Vernon again. He had a show on BAI, him and Greg Tate.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him my demo of my band. At that time, it was called Dark Sarcasm. And Columbia Records was interested in signing my band at that time. And I went through a few, you know, interviews, etc. And I gave Vernon the cassette. And he freaked out and was like, I want to play this on my radio show. So we were in this beginning of the relationship, this really harmonic, you know, avant-garde, you know, jazz, art rock conversations, just in the early friendship days. And then when he asked me to play in the band, I just thought he was going to continue that. But Living Color actually became a more solidified idea than what I thought it was going to be in rock. So I just wanted to be clear to him, and not necessarily say that I was a jazz drummer, but I just felt like he was stressing rock so much, and I think it was a lot of his frustrations with people telling him that it wasn't going to happen, and you shouldn't do it, and you couldn't do it. And he was like, the rock was like the big heavy word at the time. And I was just making sure to him that he didn't mean, you know, the hair with the fans flowing and, you know, the spinning of the sticks and the spitting water into the crowd and putting your foot through the monitors, etc. Like, I wasn't interested in that.
Right.
And I didn't think he was, but, you know, clarity is always the best way to start a relationship, you know. So I didn't kind of say it in the way, like, I'm a jazz drummer, but Vernon knew a bit about me at that time. I was with Harry Belafonte at that time, so he knew that I was diverse. And he knew that I was a fan of Elvin, and I was at the Vanguard checking out a lot of jazz cats. I was studying with Kenwood Dinard. I was studying with Horace Arnold at the time. He knew that I was studying and researching, and jazz is my favorite music to play. But he just wanted me to know, like, it's rock. And then once we started to work on the music, I just wanted to let him know, I'm going to approach this music with sound ideas and not style ideas. I'm not going to approach it like a rock drummer playing Cult of Personality or playing Funny Vibe. I wanted to just listen to the music and hear it and then take what I knew and applied it to sounds and melody and rhythm and time that was happening in the music. And that's how I look at music. And I learned that from many trips to Africa, from master musicians in Africa. Mexico, who taught me much about the importance of sound and how you relate to sound as relating to nature. It's the same kind of thing. And the styles will get you sometimes stuck in pause. You get into the stylistic thing. Now, yes, every art form has a language, and it's good to learn it, but that's not the only language you have to necessarily speak when you communicate with people.
Right. Another thing I've also read is when you saw Elvin Jones, one of the things that you appreciated about him was the fact that he also spoke varying languages on his drum.
Absolutely. Elvin had a deep connection to me with the Congo and parts of West Africa from what I've heard growing up and researched, and Elvin could swing at the doors off a jazz club. Mm-hmm. He played elegantly with brushes like a figure skater, you know, on ice, and then he had this gorgeous mallet technique of this classical, tonal, almost timpani type approach, and he had all these things, you know. I always describe Elvin as the heavyweight champion and the ballet dancer, like in the same stroke, you know, and he bent time, you know, he actually bent time. Watching Elvin sometimes play a fill was kind of like looking at a scene from The Matrix, when you shoot a bullet and this guy kind of bends backwards.
Right.
And that's kind of how Elvin's ride cymbal time, if you can put it in a visual sense, it slows down and you see the trails of it, but it doesn't hit you, it kind of goes around you, you know. That's my description anyway. To see him at 14 years old, and then, you know, I saw Blakey before, and I saw Max before, and I saw Charlie Persop before, and Jabali, and Horace Arnold, and so many great drummers. Elvin was just speaking a different language in the same sort of vocabulary, in a sense, but he was just making up different words and creating new sentences and new approaches. There is this jazz drumming language, and it was created by great masters, Sid Catlett and Papa Joe and Philly Joe, and there's these phrases and techniques and cadences that are played in the music. And Elvin wasn't doing that. His cross-sticking thing wasn't the cross-sticking thing that we know. His crossovers weren't the crossovers that we know. His 3-4 time was not the 3-4 time out of the book. It was very African, the 3-4 and 12-8 time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, when you're 14 years old and you get cold water thrown on you at a concert like that, it was very life-changing for me.
Well, you mentioned J.T. Lewis earlier, and J.T. had shared with us, he was a guest on Sugar, and he mentioned how Elvin helped him with his brushwork because he needed help, apparently, and so Elvin gave him a lesson while sitting on a bar stool, so it was apparently a very valuable lesson. J.T. was with Don Pullen.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, anything from Elvin or any drummer from that generation, Ed Dick was one of my favorite jazz brush players, and Ed told me you should be able to play these same patterns on a phone book or a newspaper, and if it sounds the same, then your technique is right, and Ed Dick did play those patterns on a phone book and a newspaper, and it did sound the same, so he didn't just say it. And the paper shouldn't rip, and you shouldn't sound violent at all. It should be really, really smooth. We'll be right back.
Well, you had already expressed your appreciation for Elvin Jones on your Native Lands release with a cover of Three Card Molly and your composition, Echoes of Elvin. Why did you believe it was time for you to devote an entire release recognizing Elvin Jones?
Probably because I was thinking about it years before that recording. Honestly, answering that question, I just really felt like it was late. But things come when they come.
Right.
Motema Records is a great label, and Jana and I actually are friends. Jana Herzen is the owner of the record company.
Right.
Jana and I were friends 5 or 6 years before we decided to do any business together. And we talked about projects and world music. And at that time, I was going to West Africa like 4 or 5 times a year. She was asking, what are you doing over there? And I was bringing back music for her to listen to and check out this Balafon guy. So we were kind of just muso mates for a couple of years. And then she asked me to do a record for Motema, which is Life in This World. And I did. And it was great. And we talked about, what do you want to do, Will? And I originally wanted to do an Elvin Jones tribute. But at the time, I thought about covering On the Mountaintop, the entire record. And Destiny, I mentioned that. That's like my favorite track on that record, which I put on the new recording. But I just like the recording. I like Elvin's approach in that acoustic electric context because it's Elvin Jones. It's not Elvin trying to play fusion. It's not Elvin changing his drum sound or changing his approach. It's Elvin. And as Bruce Lee said, you know, when you can become the water, you're a master.
Right.
And, you know, Elvin definitely was the water, whatever situation he was in. That's the thing that attracted me originally to want to do it. So when Jana gave me the opportunity, I spent a little bit of time thinking about that record and Coltrane's music. And I went on a little bit of a project for a year, and I interviewed people. I had lunch with Sonny Fortune, and I talked to the musicians that were in Elvin's band. And I decided to create what I created and make a combination of a little Coltrane piece, Wayne Shorter piece, Elvin piece, one of my own pieces, which I'm playing guitar on a lot.
Yes, the one that we use on our promo, Samasta.
Samasta.
that's the one you play guitar on.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. What does it mean, and how did it come about?
From my side, it means mystic.
Oh.
And Alvin was a mystic to me. And mystic in that he had all of these things going on in his drumming that was mysterious and profound and amazing and not easy to get to. Some of it you had taken in bits and pieces. So one of the things, many things Alvin does at the top of his level to me is he can play really amazing slow tempo jazz. He can swing without brushes with the sticks on the ride cymbal insanely slow. It's always fascinated how in the middle of a ballad you pick up a stick and just go ting, ting to ting. Ting to ting. You're like, it has to fall apart at some point. And it never does. You know, so I thought I have to do something really kind of slow, and I decided to put the guitar element of Alvin's influence and the slow tempo vibe into the same song. I've been fooling around with that melody on the guitar for, you know, a couple of weeks, and then I played it for Antoine, and he's like, man, we gotta cut that, man, we gotta cut it. I put a loop on that was only in my head, so the guys wouldn't hear it, because we did start to lose the tempo at times just in experimenting with the song. So I said, guys, I just made this kind of cheesy ambient kind of hip-hop loop on a drum machine and just fed it to my headphone mix so I can have the time there. Then I had the guys play with me so the time didn't get lost. Christian and those guys locked right into my time. So I was joking with them on the playback, and I would take my drums out and put the drum machine on. I didn't tell them I did that.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, oh... Oh, wow. And I said, yeah, man, you can do a remix of this. You can put this out. That was one of my recording techniques that I do sometimes when working with tracks. And sometimes artists don't know that I do, but it's just better to have that. So if they want to go back and change anything or what have you, it's there. I experimented also with using both. Antoine's soprano saxophone performance was really gorgeous on both takes. So I decided I couldn't choose which take for the end of his solo. So I used both performances. So you're hearing two, I spread on left and right, you're hearing two sopranos, and one's buried and one's a little bit higher. And I just like that as a romantic kind of emotional sound. It's not just one horn, it's two horns, it's two voices speaking the same language.
Nice.
So my stuff means mystic, and there definitely was this really elegant mystic side to Elvin's musicianship on a whole, not just his drumming, but certainly his drumming.
And of course, this is a selection, because there's always some selection that just seems too short. This is one of those. It's like I'm enjoying the ride so much, and then it's just, okay, you're on your own. See ya.
Yeah, it's short. It's meant to just be that statement. I didn't really have a plan for it. It just kind of ended. I mean, Christian kind of laughed at one of the takes, because he was like, man, this is a hit, man. This is, but it's over, you know.
Yeah.
You know, do you want it to go on longer? Maybe live, you know, I'll move a little bit longer on it. But, you know, with art, sometimes it's just, you know, you see a canvas piece and somebody throws one color on it, and that's it.
Sure. Yes.
If you just relate to the definition and the depth and how it works off the canvas and what's there, it's actually multicolor in your mind. So you may be looking at a black paint maybe on a white canvas, but if it has definition to it, you're going to see yellow and orange and purple and green, you know. And if you don't see it, you're probably going to feel it. And art will tell you a lot of times when to stop.
Oh, no, I oversee that. I do. It's just, I'm just selfish. That's
No. It's funny because you're saying that, and when it, you know, I wrote the melody and it's a little play on the end, and that's kind of was it, and everyone looked at me like, well, you got something else for that tune? So I'm like, nah, man. And then when we played it back, everyone said, wow, it's perfect. And then Antoine said, yo, man, you got any more guitar songs you want to cut while we're here?
Right. Well, at least it's longer than Shinjitsu.
Yeah, well, Shinjitsu is a long piece like Doll of the Bride.
And
it's played in the same format, solo, cadence, you know, solo, band, cadence, out. So it's similar to Doll of the Bride, and I didn't want to do two of the same kind of formatted songs on the recording with the same formula. So I used Shinjitsu just as respectful. I just wanted to play the head of it. And for those who've seen Alvin many times, knows he always plays this song pretty often in his shows. I just wanted to really just divide Shinjitsu without getting deeply into it. And in the celebration, it's difficult. It's like doing a tribute to any famous writer or filmmaker or actor, etc. Sometimes it's the small, powerful minds or that have the most, you know, you can think about Sidney Poitier saying, they call me Mr. Tip. I mean, that was a big line.
Right.
You hear that, it was a profound moment.
Exactly.
Of all the brilliant work Sidney Poitier has done, when you say that line, it brings you back to that place and what was happening in that film and his role and how he was changing Hollywood. So
that's true.
Sometimes it's just a short statement.
Before we go away from Sarmasta, do you plan to play guitar more in the future?
Yeah, I'm taking my little Kumbaya uptown lessons right now. I've got my little Mel Bay guitar book. You know, I'm on the porch with my lemonade sometimes.
Okay.
You know, getting my little Kumbaya game on. So I'm just sharpening my skills up. So the time is right. That was my first time doing it. So thank you for listening and enjoying that piece. But I hope to have a little bit more to say. But it's a beautiful instrument to write on. Mm-hmm. You know, I normally write on piano or bass, and it's a totally different vibe than piano or bass. So I'm experimenting with, you know, sitting at the piano with the guitar on and trying to connect those languages now, because I kind of have much more formal piano training, and the guitar really is set up differently for you to play chords and to do different things. And as a drummer, your hands and your fingers play this kind of a role, and the guitar is not like the piano in that the most difficult part for me was just, you know, getting able to play the chords and hold the frets, hold your fingers down on the frets to get a clean sound on all the strings. And, you know, there's a lot of academics to playing guitar. Now I get why guitar players are the way that they are. I learned more about guitar players than I started playing. I should have started 20 years ago.
Wow.
Because now I'm like, now I get the personality deal. Now I see. Well, Elvis played great guitar. You know?
Really?
Yeah, there's a recording, and I'm sorry I don't know it now that we're on the phone.
I'm going to have to find it.
Yeah, he was playing guitar. famous photograph, which went around Facebook in front of a hotel in Japan with Art Blakey, a very young Tony Williams, and Elvin, and he has a guitar in a shopping bag.
Wow.
Yeah, I heard a lot of great stories about his guitar. I didn't want to do that. I just felt like now was the time, and I recorded Three Card Molly and Echoes of Elvin on Native Lands because I completed the recording, and I was mixing the record when I got the news that he'd passed.
Mm.
So I called Keiko's widow up, and I asked permission to cover the song and wanted her to know that I was going to do it, and she said, do me a favor and just cut it without piano. Elvin liked playing that song without piano, so that's why it's just bass, soprano, and drums on that track. So I went back in the middle of my mix session to cut Three Card Molly and Echoes of Elvin as closure, because I wanted him to hear the record when it was completed anyway.
We
spoke before I went in. So that was really more me paying my respects after getting that news. So I didn't want to put Three Card Molly on this record because, to be honest with you, spiritually, it just didn't feel good doing it again. And playing it in this environment, the intentions were different. The intentions, I think, were correct at the time when I was recording Native Lands. I didn't want to have sort of new academic intentions to do it on the Elvin record. I wanted to try EJ Blues and other songs and not, you know, Doll of the Bride and Shinjitsu and those kind of songs that he plays in his set,
mm-hmm.
and not do Three Card Molly just because it's a recognizable Elvin Jones track.
Right.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar and My Bowl's the name of this program. What you're listening to right now is EJ Blues from Will Calhoun's latest release, Celebrating Elvin Jones. This is a 2016 Motema Records release. On this selection, we have Will Calhoun on drums, Christian McBride on bass, Antoine Roney on tenor or soprano saxophone, Carlos McKinney on piano, and Keon Harold on trumpet. And there are a couple of special guests on this release as well, and we'll mention them later in the broadcast. Before that, we heard Elvin's Guitar Blues. That's Elvin Jones and Richard Davis. Heavy Sounds is the name of that release, a 1967 Impulse Records recording. Elvin Jones on the guitar intro and drums, Frank Foster on tenor sax, Richard Davis on bass, and Billy Green on piano. Before that, we heard Shinjitsu. This is also from Celebrating Elvin Jones. And for a pledge of $25, this release can be yours as a thank you gift for your generous support to WBAI, which we will definitely appreciate. There aren't that many copies, so the faster you call in, the sooner you'll be able to hear this without my chatting. 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or you can go to give the number to WBAI.org. That's give the number to WBAI.org. Before that, we heard Sarmasta, also from Celebrating Elvin Jones. Before that, we heard from Native Lands, two selections in tribute to Elvin Jones, Three Card Molly and Echoes of Elvin. On Three Card Molly, we have Antoine Roney on soprano saxophone, John Benitez on bass, and Will Calhoun on drums. On Echoes of Elvin, that is a drum solo with Will Calhoun. Before that, we opened the program with Shannon Jackson and the Decoding Society, Street Priests. That's the title cut from the Moore, M-O-E-R-S, Music 1981 release. We have Ronald Shannon Jackson on drums and arrangements. Electric bass is Melvin Gibbs and Reverend Bruce Johnson. Electric guitar, Vernon Reed. Saxophone, Lee Rossi and Zane Massey. Flute, Ronald Shannon Jackson, along with Zane Massey. Before that, we heard our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, and that is from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967, 1972. This is an RCA BMG compilation that was released in 1998. The recording was originally released in 1967. Stay tuned for our associate producer, Hank Williams, with his On the Bandstand segment. You'll hear about Sugar Guests and what they're doing around town so you can see them live. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Reach out to us. Get your hands on Celebrating Elvin Jones from Will Calhoun by calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or go to give the number 2 WBAI.org. That's give the number 2 WBAI.org. Stay tuned.
Decide which musicians were going to be on the recording?
Well, it was a process. Carlos McKinney's playing piano, and he was just one of my favorite piano players that I saw in the Jazz Machine, the many versions of the Jazz Machine band. I like what Carlos brought to the table, so I was already a fan of Carlos McKinney off the bat. I know he went out and started to do a little bit more commercial music in the last few years. He's doing this really great, actually, with more pop artists, the Rihannas and the Beyoncés and the loops and tracks and those kind of things for recording. So, but he's a Detroit cat and comes from a serious family of great players, the McKinneys in Detroit. So he was important for me. And Elvin's from Detroit. Mm-hmm. So it was very important for me to have Carlos. Antoine Roney is like my big brother. We're great friends. And I work with him and his brother and Wallace Roney quite often as much as possible. I learned a lot from both of those guys. Tony Williams took them under their wing. So if you want to get really good Tony stories, you got to hang out with Wallace and Antoine.
As a matter of fact, I'm planning the Roney Brothers story for Sugar My Bowl, because those guys have so much history in New York that it's got to be documented. Okay.
Well, thank you for doing that, and that has to be done, and I will, as I always listen to your show, I'll make sure I have that one tuned in, because that's going to be, I think, a game changer for those two brilliant, brilliant brothers and great souls.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for August 7th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's show features drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun. You can catch him in a free outdoor show on the 12th at Marcus Garvey Park as part of the Jazzmobile series, or with Living Color at the Afro Punk Fest in Brooklyn on the 28th. And we also have several premiums for you in this Pledge Drive edition. Autographed copies of Calhoun's brand new CD, Celebrating Elvin Jones, are available for a pledge of only $25, which also includes a year's membership. We only have a few of them, so call 516-620-3602 right now, or go online to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. We also still have a few copies of the Perfection CD by the Mac Power Trio of David Murray, Jerry Allen, and drummer Terry Lynn Carrington. That's also a $25 pledge. And there are a few autographed copies of Quincy Troupe's Miles and Me book about his relationship with the great trumpeter Miles Davis, and those are available for a $35 pledge. And again, all include a year's membership in WBAI, and we give many thanks to Motema Records for their generous donation of the CDs. We'll repeat that at the end of the segment, but right now we have music listings for you. Harpist Brandy Younger has weekly Sunday brunch sets at Minton's in Harlem. Organist John Medeski is at the Village Vanguard with pianist Yuri Kane on the 9th. Drummer Cindy Blackman Santana is at Jazz Standard on the 9th through the 10th. Pianist and keyboardist Mark Carey hosts the Harlem Sessions at Ginny's Supper Club on the 11th and following Thursdays through August. Drummer Jeff Tane Watts leads a quartet at Jazz Standard from the 11th through the 14th. Vocalist D.D. Bridgewater and bassist Christian McBride are at the Montclair Jazz Festival on the 13th. Bassist William Parker and drummer Hamid Drake are at the Stone from the 17th through 20th with guitarist Joe Morris. Pianist Randy Weston leads the African Rhythms Ensemble with bassist Alex Blake at the Jazz in the Valley Festival in Poughkeepsie, New York on the 21st. And if you miss them there, they'll be at the Charlie Parker Jazz Fest in Marcus Garvey Park on the 27th. Trombonist Craig Harris is also at the Jazz in the Valley Festival on the 21st. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria leads the Multiverse Big Band at Grant's Tomb for a free outdoor performance, and that's also part of Jazzmobile series, and that's on the 24th. Percussionist Steve Kroon is at the Louis Armstrong House and Museum in Queens, and that's a free outdoor performance as part of the Jazzmobile series on the 25th. Finally, guitarist Julian Lage is at the Stone with fellow guitarist Nels Klein on the 25th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. Again, autographed copies of Will Calhoun's Celebrating Elvin Jones CD are available for a $25 pledge, and the Mac Power Trio's Perfection CD or autographed copies of Quincy Troupe's Miles and Me book are available for $25 or $35 respectively. All include a year's station membership, and remember that you can pledge as little as $5 to support community radio. Call 516-620-3602 right now, or go online to give2wbai.org. That's 516-620-3602, or give to WBAI.org. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on Sunday, August 21st. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Hello, this is Hugh Masekela in New York. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. Don't lose your mind. Don't move that dial. Don't groove to anything else.
Antoine's kind of like a kind of cat. We just talk about politics and science. We're both into science and astrology and spirituality and international politics. And so Antoine and I just like, we rap without talking about music at all. He's a very intelligent, very soft-spoken, but he's very, very intellectually sound and very well-read brother. And he's a fan of African culture, African art. We talk a lot about, you know, history. And he showed me, by the way, an amazing picture of Elvin Jones surrounded by hand drummers.
Wow.
And I said, man, how'd you get this photo? And he said, man, we went to Africa one time and we got off the plane and they were just drummers. Like Elvin came down the stairs and there was just cats playing. And he said, Elvin said, I want to go play with these guys. So they put the drums in the car and they went to the bush and just played.
Wow. Nice.
So he has a photograph of Elvin surrounded by these hand drummers in the bush. It's a great photograph. It's a beautiful photograph. Antoine automatically, because he spent many years in the band, knew a lot of the stories. I didn't know what music I wanted to do. And Antoine had lots of live recordings. So it was great to hook up with Antoine and listen to 20 versions of Doll of the Bride and 20 versions of EJ Blues. And, you know, just to have that homework, you know, to have that research material available to me was fantastic. And Antoine has a lot of great recordings of Elvin tours and solos and what he was approaching. And he was listening back going, man, I didn't know Elvin hit that thing three times. I thought he only hit it twice. Mm-hmm. All of these times I was playing on the tour. I thought it was interesting that Antoine was discovering things of recordings he had for 10, 15 years. So Antoine was an automatic special agent because of his connection to Elvin and the history of Elvin. And he's a great musician. He's a great song player. He toured with me on my native land, touring Europe twice, actually. So we have a great connection. I love playing with him. He's a great musician, a great guy to play with. So Antoine came on. Keon Harrell was kind of last because I was doing something for the wonderful Margaret Troop at a benefit for her organization she has in her hometown.
Right. And the name of Margaret Porter Troop's group is the Gloucester Arts Project.
Right. Thank you for that. She had a fundraiser for the Gloucester Art Project, and if those of you feel inclined, you can go online, look it up, and make a donation because she's bringing art to communities that are really, I mean, barely have schools in some of those towns. So I went to the fundraiser when I played. I hadn't seen Keon in quite some time, and he was there, and he played, and I said, hey, I'm going to go cut this Elvin record, and would you like to do it? And he said, sure. And it was just one of those timing issues. So I brought Keon on, and Christian McBride were on a recording date together. I'm sorry, I don't remember the young man's name. He's a prodigy out of New Jersey. He's a 14-year-old young blind keyboard player who's insanely genius, organ, piano.
Matthew Whitaker.
Yes. Thank you. Nice talking to you. I can always connect my facts, right? So I do appreciate that. But we were on a Matthew Whitaker session, and we were packing up. And he said, Calhoun, what's next? And I said, oh, I'm going to do this Elvin project. He says, man, I got to get down on that, man. Christian is so busy and is doing so many fantastic things. I just didn't think it was going to work out. So he called me the next day and said, look, I had these 2 days in April. If you can do it then, and, you know, I'm on it. And why turn Christian McBride down, who's excited about playing on your record? That would be intelligent.
No.
So, and, you know, it was great respect for Elvin, but we had fun doing it, which, you know, doesn't always happen in a recording studio. And me, although I was leaving the session, it was just good to hear everyone's Elvin stories in between songs. Remember when this? Remember when we were in Japan? He got off the train. Someone left a cymbal bag and all that. You know, I was hearing all of these great stories. It made the recording session just more fertile for great ideas and different takes, although I basically used first takes on this recording.
Oh, wow.
I was really surprised how everyone just came in really and just blew the doors off the joint. I mean, I didn't rehearse the music. Christian had a limited schedule and I had the charts, and we just went over some stuff and talked about it and played it. And I tried to do the old school, you know, do two versions and then just see which one you like the best. And it was difficult to choose from many songs, actually. So Christian's approach, I mean, you know, I let him do his own thing, and he thanked me. I was like, man, just play, dude. He's like, well, I took a bass solo on the last one. I said, so take a solo on the next one. So what? Who's counting solos? What is this, a solo count here? If you feel the vibe, play. If you don't feel the vibe, don't play. But, you know, I know you took a solo on the last one. We finished with that one. Now we're on to another one. It's fun. And his bass solos are killing.
Yes.
I mean, amazing and adventurous. And, you know, he's just hip. He plays funk and jazz and, you know, disco.
Well, there's one that I really hadn't heard, but, and then I actually had to look him up. Wilbur Little. Shoo!
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. I never like saying that into the microphone when I'm introducing that song.
But it was, yeah, I mean, it, well, that's also one of the selections that Christian McBride sort of goes out on. I noticed that for that particular representation on the recording, it exhibits Elvin Jones with a trio when he was playing with Tommy Flanagan on piano and Wilbur Little on bass.
Yes.
How did you decide that you would include
the Well, it's from his recording, Pilot Currents. It's a great record. Mm-hmm. And it's a great sounding recording. That record was played very often in my room growing up in my mom's house. And it has an edgier blue note sound to it. So I'm always into production. And I like the way the record sounds and the way Elvin Jones sound in that recording. So it was one of those records that I just played often in my room. It was a choice of just, you know, loving the track. But Carlos's playing is brilliant on there. And he lays out. He's not always up in the mix, which is brilliant, too. So when the piano comes in, it's so refreshing. The piano solo on there is quite amazing. And I love his approach to the whole song. I didn't have to say anything. He worked with Elvin for years. He knows the song. And I didn't have to say, yo, man, check this out, dude. Lay out. You know, Elvin got this trio. And then, you know, it's not fair, really, to approach art in that way to me. If you're trying to make a statement, you have to let things happen. If it was too much, I would have said something afterwards. But, you know, Carlos was brilliant, and he played wonderfully on the track. So I didn't want to change it in that aspect. And the fact that Elvin didn't use a piano player, I didn't want to try to see where it would move with chords. Mm. And Carlos pulls the song in some other direction, especially during his solo.
Right.
We were going into some really kind of almost avant-garde sections and time-changing sections in the solo. So it was a wonderful opportunity to take a beautiful song and sort of stretch it a bit. And we lost around a little bit in there, fooled around with a couple of things, but I think it was a great combination of energy and artistry, and it made it easy for me as a producer, and as it being my date, it was really easy for me to kind of deal with the music. I could just play and not feel like I had to jump off the kitten on here and went there. It was very loose.
Wow. Nice. The longest song on this recording, which runs over 15 minutes, we may not be able to play all of, but Doll of the Bride. Okay. It's a traditional Japanese folk song, and it features Dudu and Dai Rose. How did that come up?
Yes. Let me just first say, if you go online and look up Doll of the Bride, mm-hmm. you'll probably find many, many versions that are much longer than mine. But I wanted to pay respect to how Elvin plays the song. Mm-hmm. And it's a cadence. It's a drum solo up front. Mm-hmm. And then it's a cadence, and then there's another drum solo, and then we go into like a slow Latin feel, and there's another drum solo, and there's the cadence. Mm-hmm. And that's Elvin's format for that song, so I didn't want to not do that, you know. Number one. Number two, I didn't care how long it was. It just had to feel good to me. If it doesn't make it onto radio, I didn't do that song as a radio track. I did it for the celebration of his legacy. So I do wonder, it's a shame that sometimes you get into those moments of length of time with advertising, etc. But it's that is the length. And Dudu was on the track. Dudu passed away last year. Senegalese drum master and someone I had the fortunate time in during my visits in Senegal to spend time with him and to learn about some of these 40,000-year-old plus rhythmic traditions that deal with the harvest and rain and healthy pregnancies, and they're not related to dance and groove and, you know, funk and rock and drum and bass. It's not that kind of thing. It's coming from a totally spiritual place.
Right.
And to understand that, you'll understand why people dance and pray and so on. You know, when you get the first part, you'll understand the second part.
Right.
I was fortunate enough to visit his house with a longtime friend from Harlem, actually, who passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago. And he's like an uncle of mine. He introduced me to a lot of African traditions over the years. He was a silversmith in Harlem, and he had a jewelry store. And after he would close his store, he would go in the back and have the debates. You know, we would get chepujin, put the newspaper on the floor, one plate, everybody get a couple of spoons. And we talked about culture and music and presidents and wars and those kind of things that were going on in Africa. So he was a good friend of Dudu's, and I didn't know. So I was in Senegal with him, with his family at his house having dinner, and he said, get in the car, let's go. And I said, where are we going? He took me to Dudu's house, and I was completely shocked. So we met Dudu and was a fan of his, and I met him a few times on the road doing concerts, but to be in his home was really breathtaking. And he always said, young man, what do you want to play? And then, you know, me being from the Bronx and not wanting to waste time, I'm like, I want want to record something with you. Because I've been listening to you for years, and I don't think I have anything right of your ideas, and I'd like to first go over some of the things that I know about your music and try to transfer that to Kit. So can we start out the session maybe a couple of hours of getting it right, because I know I have it wrong. And he said, sure. And I booked the session all day. I had an engineer, and I told the engineer, when his foot comes in the studio and touches the floor, you push record. When his foot leaves the studio and he gets into the car, you push stop. I want a microphone in the bathroom. I want a microphone in the hallway. I want a microphone. I knew I wasn't going to have that opportunity ever again with that level of intelligence about the instrument and history. And of course, the African vibe. I love the West African vibe. It's like, you know, you invite 10 people and they bring 30. It's just fantastic, you know. Food, and somebody's chatting, somebody went to get lamb, somebody's getting fish. You know, it's just so amazing. Yeah. It's way past anything to me that we could imagine, Christmas or Thanksgiving or whatever, these kind of holidays. We're so far past that, you know. Mm-hmm. And have all the energies in the room, and somebody's sister and their aunt and the grandma and the nana and the granddad, the original guy, and the guy who doesn't play anymore, but he started this rhythm, mm-hmm. they're all there. So you really get properly educated right. in a situation like that. So, yeah, I spent a half a day in the studio with Dudu and Dye Rose and eight of his sons. He used to have this group. It still exists, but about 40 players, most of them his sons and his daughters. You look them up online, go check out one of my favorite recordings is Jabate's D-J-A-B-O-T-E.
What?
a DVD of it, recording on the Gory Island with the drummers, and you have to just see it and hear it. It's life-changing. But I've been a fan, so I booked a studio time, paid the engineer, and went in, played what I thought was was the vibe, and he was kindly enough saying, well, actually, you're hearing it upside down. It's actually here.
Wow.
And then he explained why, and he played it really slow, and I videotaped the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
And then I was like, wow, was I off? And wow, is it even cooler now that he showed me really where it is?
Right.
So we worked on it, and I worked on parts, and then he said, what can you do? What do you want to offer? What do you want to play that we could join you on? And you know, of course, I was sitting there like, huh? But I started to play a couple of different things and different bass drum sonatas and different feels, and he told his sons, listen to what he's doing. Listen first. Listen for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Listen to all of the hi-hat and everything. Then we do just one drum and we add parts. So the whole experience was educational. And then I had the best interruption of all time. Senegal TV came in, and, you know, Africa. The African vibe is great because it's like, it's just what it is. Someone told this woman, who was one of his young nieces, that he was in the studio with me, and they came with television cameras. So she knocks on the door and says, excuse me, my great uncle or whatever's here, and from TV, and people recognized her. It's very stunning. Sister comes in with all these cats, and they're like, well, right in the middle of the session, right in the middle of playing. Dudu's kind. He says, you know, let's just finish this track. And then he decides, since I'm there, I'm going to talk about the history of Sabah.
Oh, my.
So it was all, and this is deep. One of the drummers told me some of the language he was slipping into was older Wolof. It wasn't the Wolof that he grew up. This guy was 60. And he said, I didn't grow up speaking that, but I heard my father speak like this.
Wow.
So I got my camera out and filmed it.
Well, he was playing Sabar, wasn't he? Somebody was playing Sabar.
Yes, yes,
I heard
yes.
it.
And he broke the rhythms down into gender of how the male's energy is this and the female, because there's a lot of female drummers in his group, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I heard you say. I was going to ask, what are they playing?
Yeah, no, they're singing and playing, but it made so much sense because I think in this part of the world, we look at drumming kind of one way, whether it's a female or male playing, but there are female and male energies involved in those rhythms.
Right.
And I think it's important to know them.
Right.
So he broke down so many things, and it's like, I didn't know what was happening. I just saw it. It was amazing. And all of these older guys, and I don't mean to say older, but the guys that were older than me, that were 60, you know, these are master guys I saw play. They were going, oh my God, oh, I never knew that, oh.
Wow.
So I'm sitting there going like, whoa, this must be deep. So I haven't had it all translated yet, but I did record the whole thing. So I recorded that. I held on to it for a while, and I was going to put that on another recording, and I just sat on it, and I learned it and reviewed it and did my homework on it. And then doing the Elvin Jones recording, I felt I have to connect Dudu and Elvin. There has to be a way to do that. So Dollar the Bride, I start out, and unfortunately it's briefly with his drum group, and then I go to my solo with the hands, with my hands on the drum kit, which is some of the things that Dudu taught me. And then I go to the sticks, and then we go into Elvin's version of Dollar the Bride, where he plays a 5/4 in his version. I'm playing more like a bayou, an African bayou, Afro-Brazilian bayou rhythm. And then the other stuff's on top. If you listen to Elvin's version, he plays a very slick fill over. It's 1, 2, 3, 4. So every third bar is the one. And over that melody, he's playing this kind of really cool triplet thing, if he is version. So I wanted to play this song, but I wanted to do my West African introduction influence of Dollar the Bride, and I play it exactly the way Elvin rhythmically plays it, but to still have the intensity and the vibe of Elvin. sorry to get long-winded on that one, but it's a big question. It's a question that covers a lot of time and a lot of experiences. You know, when you have an idea, it's difficult to commercialize it. You don't want to really, you know, sort of homogenize the brilliance of these gentlemen and his work. You can't take something like that and pour it in a glass and put ice in it with a straw, you know, and an umbrella, you know. It's way deeper.
Well, that's definitely why you're on WBAI and Sugar in My Bowl, and that's why we're offering this CD during this fund drive. And if people call 516-620-3602, that's 516-620-3602, you can pledge. And for the thank you for your membership, we will honor you with the CD celebrating Vin Jones by Will Calhoun. And thank you, Motema Records, for providing that opportunity.
Well, I want to say something now that you said that, because I'm a lifetime WBAI listener. I'm a premium fanatic. When you used to be able to go down to Wall Street, I used to just go in the premium room and just take a check and pull everything off the shelves and walk out of there at that time.
Right.
I know it's a different scenario now, but I always wanted to make my own contribution towards the radio station, and this is the first time, actually, and I'm really proud, thanks to you and your show, that I have this opportunity, because Michael G. Haskins, there's so many great people over there that are doing great things, and they play my music.
That is true.
Which I have to thank the radio station for, and you do as well, and to be able to finally have my CD be a part of supporting of the station is a huge honor, so thank you for that.
And thank you. You know, there's one musician that we did not mention, Jan Hammer.
Sure. Jan Hammer is playing on the track Destiny. Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that up. And what can I tell you? Jan's a game-changer musician as well. And for those of you who know, he's just a brilliant pianist, keyboardist, arranger. Did a lot of great music with Mahavishnu Orchestra and Jeff Beck.
He provided the theme to Miami Vice.
That's what's kind of put him on a more commercial map.
Right.
He does music now, probably for CNN and so many other network shows, but still an insanely brilliant musician. And I'm a huge fan of Jan. I have all of his solo records, and in the second recording phase of the new Living Color CD, we were upstate in my New York recording, and the engineer, we took like a day break, and the engineer wanted to hear the Alvin record, and I said sure, and I played him tracks, and he said, wow, this is great, and I played him Destiny, and I did it first with the guys, and I said, you know, I was really thought about just getting Jan on that recording. He goes, now why don't you go, he's not far from here. He said, have you talked to him before? I said yeah, actually I've spoken to Jan before. He said, man, you should just give him a call, man, what the hell, the record's done, it sounds great, but just give him a call. You never know.
Wow.
And I called Jan, and he was like, sure.
Excellent.
Which was shocking. And he also mixed and edited that track, which is kind of him to do. And he sent me a lovely email saying, I got a gift for you. Check it out. If you don't like it, you don't have to use it. But I did a little edit and a mix for you. And then we spoke briefly, and he talked to me about how he mixed Jeff Beck's Wide record and sent the mixes into Columbia. And they said they were terrible, but then they wound up using them. And he recorded and mixed Tony Williams' Joy of Flying record, and the same thing happened. So we were just joking about that. So with those stories, I had no desire not to use his mix.
Sure, right?
But he did an excellent job. That mix sounds great, and I love that track. It's written by the great bassist Gene Perla. Mm-hmm. And I've listened to that track. I can't even tell you how many. I mean, that record is one of my records that the grooves are probably worn out, but I love that song. It's a fantastic song. And this project and the music on this project are songs that I thought about doing in some sort of fashion for, you know, more than 25 years. So I'm excited to have this recording together, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss it with your audience.
So is there something more you'd like to share with regard to celebrating Elvin Jones, your release, that is actually going to be available on August 19th? And you're going to be at Jazzmobile on the 12th, August 12th, Marcus Garvey Park.
Yes, I'll be at Marcus Garvey. Come on down and check out some music and hang and enjoy the beautiful community and the vibe in Harlem. I'm a fan of Jazzmobile, and I remember seeing Dexter in the park growing up in New York, and Art Blakey, and I remember going back, which wasn't really a backstage, it was just a little bit of roped off area at Grand's Tomb, and I got a chance to meet Art Blakey and talk to him.
Nice.
You know, those concerts, that series for me growing up in New York was priceless, just seeing all that amazing talent, you know, coming up on stage. You know, when it was summertime, and you're 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, and it's not the ice cream truck, and it's not the open fire hydrant, you know, it's something else,
right.
You know, and this this experience, which to me was really profound and priceless, really, to see these jazz stars just right in front of you. You're not Imogen Fearingard or the Blue Note or whatever was happening at that time, Fat Tuesdays, etc. You know, you're seeing people in the park, you know, where you run around and where you ride your bike and where you play basketball, and they're there playing this tremendous music. And I can't express what it was like to see those giants and talk to them and shake their hand and look at the instruments up close and go to sound checks. You know, those things are all important. And when you're a young artist, watching Blakey put a cymbal on a stand, you know, and fooling around and how he's changing his hi-hats, all these little academic things are profound educational experiences when you're young and you're thinking about being a musician. It's a lot of information there. So I went every summer to watch as many concerts as possible. So for it to still be happening now, and it needs help, yes. Mm-hmm. For those who can support the organization financially or donating a PA or a piano or whatever you can do, feel free if it needs help. But by all means, I'm going to stick by it. And if, whenever they call me to do something educational or to go into a school or to play concerts live, it's not about the bread, really. It's about the legacy. So, yeah, that's an honor to be doing something. And the people, all the people there are great. Everyone there is fantastic. So it's easy to work with that organization. I'm looking at doing a CD release nights in January at the Blue Note, a little bit further down the line. So for those, you know, I'm going to have a couple of guests I'm speaking to right now, Robbie Coltrane and a few folks. I'm hoping that all pans out, but I'm going to try to do a proper release and you know, they call it CD release party, I guess. But it'll be a hang to come and see the music and meet and greet and sign some CDs and talk to some folks, and that's always important. It'll be the same in Harlem as well. But that's the only thing I want to mention sort of down the line. And anyone who picks up the record, downloads it, listens to, you know, thank you for supporting jazz. Thank you for supporting the show, supporting this radio station, and supporting my new recording. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Will Calhoun, for doing what you do, doing your work, and loving the music, culture. And, oh, my, how could I talk to you and not discuss Asia?
Aza.
Yeah, sure. You had a visual exhibit at a
Casita
Maria.
Yes, in the Bronx.
Yes.
It's moving to another location in the Bronx, but you can go online on my Facebook page, etc., and you'll see where it's moving to. But yes, it's a visual art piece called Aza, which is a Swahili word, which means powerful.
Well, at least we have the right pronunciation now, because when Hank mentions it during our On the Bandstand segment, he says Aza. So Aza, got it.
It's called Aza, and Aza works. Aza is the female version.
Okay.
Aza is the male version. How's that?
Okay.
But to me, the art and the sound and the visual thing really is kind of the same experience, dance and poetry and music. And I've been working with technology over the last few years and experimenting with trying to bring a few of them to one sort of location, one kind of expression. It's been done in different ways. I've experimented with drum solos during my Living Color tours, where I have my little 15-minute moment by myself on stage where your eyes are closed and you're expressing yourself, and a lot of things come into your head, probably too many. And there's electronic, and there's African music, and there's jazz, and there's hip-hop, and there's rock and roll, and there's Muhammad Ali, and there's Malcolm X, and there's Coltrane. You know, I have all this. Your brain opens up into this massive encyclopedic information of expression. And I was experimenting with taking the solos and the academic solo first, the more acoustic solo on the kit, and tying in Doo-Doo and Max and, you know, all of those things, Billy Cobham and Tony and John Bonham and, you know, all of those kind of experiences of drumming. And then I go to an electronic part of my soul where I get off the kit, and I love technology. I love the pedals and the effects and the soundscapes and all of the nerdy parts of our business. Love it. So I make loops and samples and kind of electronic drums, and I get back on the kit then after making the loops and creating all of these kind of electronic sound wall and play with what I created. So it's a brilliant way to express yourself, to push yourself, in my opinion, and to create. And then the third phase is to shut all the lights off on stage and in the venue, and I pick up these light sticks that light up, and they change colors. I have different versions. Some of them change when you hit the drum. Some of them just change colors as they're moving. You're seeing now, you're not seeing me, you're not seeing the kit, you're only seeing the strokes, you're only seeing the light from the sticks. So it looks like a dancer and a butterfly and images. So I did it in L.A. once, and a gentleman who has a film videography company came to the show and was blown away and wanted to try this series of me doing it in a room. room, seven cameras at a very slow aperture photographing me and then having creating these interesting stills. And I realized how different the pictures were coming out. So the Alpha series are 13 prints of photographs. I'm not painting. They're photographs of me taking solos. I think Doug Wimbish once told me, he went up in the balcony once to watch me do it in Amsterdam. And Doug said, man, you have to see what you're doing. You have to see what you're doing. You don't know what you're doing because you can't see it. And then I realized, that looks interesting. So that's the series. And you can go to willcalhounart.com and I explain a bit how it's done. And photographers are there. A company called Four Scenes. And this gentleman's named Corey. And Corey approached me. And I'm very proud of that series. And the most selling one is one called Ethel, which is named after my sister, who is a dancer.
Yes.
Yeah, she's my girl. And she's worked with Alvin Ailey and Forces of Nathan. She's done a lot of, she's a tremendous artist in her own right. And instructor, choreographer, and a great big sister, by the way. Her favorite color is red. She's a dancer. So there's one that's called Ethel, which is a red swirl that looks like a dancer. And, of course, with her spiritual energy, that is the one that sells the most.
Yes. And if people, if they've ever seen Ethel, or if in the future they meet Ethel, and they see this piece, they will know, oh, yes, that is the piece called Ethel.
Yes, yes. Because she is also a force of nature.
Yes. And a big hand for the director, Haiti Morales, as well.
Yes, and you have to mention Christine.
Oh, yes.
A wonderful curator and loves her job and is invested in that community and those children and that gallery and the children in that community really knowing art. The importance of it is as important as science and mathematics and everything else that's going on. You know, you're talking about Aza and Aza. I'm going to mess that one up.
Licata. Christine Licata.
Sorry, the L-I-C-A-T-A, right?
That's right.
I also can see Christine standing over me with the ruler. like your old English teacher from third grade, right. Literally cracking me on his hand for not saying her name correctly. I see that. I have that vision right now, just so you know as well. She is that kind of sister. Love her a bit. No problem correcting you.
Well, thank you, Haiti and Christine, for your great work at La Casita Maria.
Yes, yes. And thank you again, and blessings to all your work. You're really doing a great job, and you have a really great show, and I always listen to it, and it's a pleasure to be on, and for supporting, you know, I always see you out in the audience on the different crazy shows that I'm doing, and
wonderful.
You're always there, and it means a lot, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Will Calhoun.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the program of which you've been listening. My name's Joyce Jones. What you're listening to in the background is Destiny, which is from Celebrating Elvin Jones, Will Calhoun's latest release. The personnel on this recording is Will Calhoun on drums, Christian McBride on bass, Antoine Roney on tenor and soprano sax, Keyon Harold on trumpet. Jan Hammer is the special guest on this recording. And before that, we heard an excerpt from Doll of the Bride. As mentioned, this is a longer track, which if you call 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org, give2wbai.org, you can get yourself a copy and hear the entire song, Doll of the Bride. It's definitely worth hearing. This is, and before that you heard Jame Duru Ndairo's from Djibouti. That is a 1994 Real World record release. Before that you heard Phew from Celebrating Elvin Jones. Before that you heard Harmonique, also from Celebrating Elvin Jones, and that's a John Coltrane composition. And before that you heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. That should be coming up next. We'll be back on the 21st of August. I hope you're going to have an opportunity to enjoy Will Calhoun's release, Celebrating Elvin Jones. You can by calling 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org. You also have an opportunity to get autographed copies of Miles and Me by Quincy Troupe, and there are still CDs available of Perfection, the release that features the Mech Power Trio. That's David Murray, Jerry Allen, and Terry Lynn Carrington. And you can find out more about those premiums by calling 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.